Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today we're going to take a look at nature and science again, and especially survival. I have done one video where I touched on the topic of the world that God created. I did a video that showed how animals really behave and the brutal nature of life itself, that nature itself is filled with incredible cruelty and absolute ruthlessness. Because you see, if you look at religion and you look at spiritual stuff, and I used to be in that world myself, and I spent decades of my life concerning myself with spirituality. I'm serious about it. I used to be very deeply into spirituality. I used to want to please God. I wanted to live forever and all that kind of stuff. I was fascinated by the spiritual, and a very important consideration was the soul. Is the soul real? Does the soul live beyond the body? These are the kinds of things that Christians believe in. I wasn't a Christian, but I still believed in those things. And I took those things seriously. And I was looking constantly for proofs of life after death, for the existence of the soul after the body has died, for the continuation of consciousness when the body is already dead. And here and there you still find some vague things that might actually suggest there is something, but I wouldn't want to go too deeply into that, and I wouldn't want to put too much stock into that. And scientists have done many experiments, strange experiments. Most of the testimony, virtually all the testimony for these things, is personal. People talking about their experiences. And if you want to know who's the greatest liar on earth, it is a person. A person is a liar. And until you've got firm proof, firm, independent, third-party proof, you cannot take the statements of people too seriously. Whatever it might be, you can't take it too seriously. But that was my world, and in that world, it was all about how your behavior will result in God rewarding you. God's going to reward you, and He's going to reward you with eternal life if you behave yourself in this life. In this life, you've got to be poor, you've got to be meek, you've got to be pathetic, and then God will give you all of eternity. Of course, the other side of the coin is, maybe it's the greatest con that exists, that you give up your life, you don't live your life, and you think you're about to have the greatest victory of all time, and then, boom, you're gone, and you know what? You didn't get anything. So you wasted your life, you lived it in a certain way, in anticipation of a heaven that you're going to personally experience, and then when you're dead, you're dead, and there is no heaven, and you experience nothing. And it was the biggest con of all. You believed you were going to get something, but you didn't get anything. However, the other side of the coin is that you maybe did help society, and that society was the winner, which is not bad, but it's a bit of a con game, and it's not something that I'm into. I'm a firm believer, and have always been a firm believer, in the truth. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The truth is everything. The truth is the only thing that matters. Everything else is child's play and stupidity. The truth is the only thing that matters. And we as people have to live and function in the truth and in reality, the way reality is. That is very important. And to sit and believe in weird things is dangerous if it impacts your existing life and your ability to function in your existing life. But these are things I do understand. I do understand what drives you there. I myself was driven there. I myself was a fool. I myself went down that path for decades of my life because it was the only way that I could survive. So I can understand the psychological and personal motivation for wanting to think like this. I understand it. But the reality is, and I'm going to tell you the answer, the real reality is that we are biological animals and we need to function as a biological unit. And I'm going to return to this topic again and again in different forms to explain to you why this is necessary and what the benefits are. But at the start of it, you must understand that if you don't have an appreciation for our people and what our people have done, then you won't have a real understanding of what we're doing and why we want to do it. When I wrote my political book, Government by Deception, right at the beginning of the book, I did say something along these lines. I went and discussed the guilt trip, and I said, in effect, that if I believed that white people were evil and that we deserved to die, I would be among the first who would agree with that if there was some fact along that line. That, you know, if we are truly evil and bad, etc., and we deserve to die, you know, I'd even be among the volunteers, you know, okay, kill me first then. That is sort of vaguely what I was getting at. I'm not quoting verbatim, I'd have to go and look it up. But anyway, that was the way that I approached the book, and then I went, and the whole book was about the fact that no, we weren't that evil, and look at what the other side has gotten up to and gotten away with in the meantime. Look at how freaking raw evil they are. And that, of course, is what Jews and liberals are hiding all the time. They're hiding all the other evil, and everybody only focuses on whites. But I understand and grasp and appreciate the depth of what the white race has achieved in history. And I have indeed pondered, you know, what is the world going to be like if whites aren't there? What if whites were all killed and whites are not there? How will that world look and how will it evolve? Actually, there's some funny stuff I can show you in that regard. And we could have some good laughs. I've got something that's really funny in that regard. You might not think it'll be funny, but it will be funny. You'll have some good laughs. But in this video, we're serious. So, what will that world be like when we are destroyed, when we are gone? And for a long time, I've been fully aware of that. For much of my life, I've been aware of that. And it's a thing that's bothered me. And I know that that world is going to be a dreadful world. Not only for the handful of whites who live in it, but for the world as a whole, for what could have been. So I personally do not have a problem with the motivation for why whites should live. And I see the survival and the prosperity and the expansion and the increasing power of Western civilization as something that I think is critically important. It's not to be toyed with. It's something that's critically important. And maybe even me using a word like prosperity, maybe I shouldn't even use words like that. The real issue is power and strength and perhaps happiness and a feeling of achievement. I should rather perhaps remove the term prosperity and replace it with happiness and a feeling of achievement. That is much better. There are some concepts we need to remove from our heads. There are some concepts that are junk Jewish ideas that have no meaning at all. Mostly when you are dealing with Jews and things related to Jews, you are dealing with what I would call unreality, non-reality. You are not dealing with reality. Whereas whites are a people of reality. If I had to perhaps even invent a term, I would say that we are the people of, let's call it, prime reality. Reality in its rawest form. Reality in the way it is. In its brutal, uncompromising, unbending form. The reality that if you make a mistake, reality will kill you. Reality will rip you to pieces if you make a mistake. One mistake will result in immediate death or dismemberment. That is the kind of prime reality where whites live. Jews live in a subset of that. They live in an unreality. They go where reality has already been conquered, and they go and parasite off that. They themselves cannot face the real reality, and they are the people of mind games and all kinds of other junk that is not reality. But real reality, as handled by the only adults around, namely whites, real reality is prime reality. It is the raw reality of the world. And that is where we are the kings, the gods, the masters. And another thing is, those of you who live in America, North America, Europe, you are limited in your ability of understanding collapse. Though the Europeans do understand collapse when they face warfare, all-out warfare, they know what total collapse is like. But because they are very functional and organized people, they can fix up collapse quickly. So for them, they know what collapse is like, but they can rebuild from collapse with great speed, especially the Germans. But for the rest of you, you don't really know what collapse is like. You've never had disaster come and visit you, except maybe in the American Civil War more than 100 years ago. What's it, almost 150 years ago. And then only really in the South. But collapse can come, and collapse can come in other ways, in other more imperceptible ways. And of course, lots of empires, lots of countries have collapsed totally. The bottom line is that I believe firmly in the mission of our race and the reason for our existence, and it's a topic I'll return to again, and maybe in a better way, in a more complete way. But I firmly believe in the benefits of our existence, even for those who aren't related to us. Even they gain benefits from our existence. But then a new question that arises in my mind these days is whether we even should be benefiting others. Should we be benefiting non-whites? Should we? Should we have gone out and civilized the world? Of course, when we went out to civilize the world, maybe using the term civilize was just a propaganda that went along with conquest. So we go and we conquer them, but we tell them, listen, we're coming to civilize you. So we're going to take charge of everything, and you're going to be reporting to us, but you're going to get benefits. And there is evidence, there's actual evidence that whites said that to blacks in Africa, and blacks themselves for a long time understood that here is this alien race, almost like aliens from outer space, who are coming into Africa and telling you, listen, we are going to show you a better way, but you must succumb to us and we will be in charge of you and you will see the benefits. And there was a black guy who in the last 60 years wrote a whole book on this basis, where blacks came back and said, well, you know, we understood this and you promised that and blah blah blah. So there was a definite understanding at certain points that this is what we're doing. Nowadays, I ask myself if that was a wise thing to do. But then again, maybe at the time it wasn't a bad idea. Maybe with much more limited resources, it was good propaganda at the time. That hundreds of years ago, that was good propaganda. But is that something we really want to continue? So there are many, many complex and different issues that we need to look at. And I'm just making you aware of some of them. So some of these things relate to cooperation, various levels and types of cooperation, etc., etc. Now, human history is written up, or our history is written up, and it's only a few thousand years long. We've only got historical records going back, say, 5,000, 6,000 years. Then in prehistory, so history is when it's written down, and that's maybe 5,000 or 6,000 years, maybe 6,500 years of writings. But then there's prehistory, when it wasn't written down, and we've got evidence for that going back 40,000, 45,000 years. In fact, just yesterday I came across what appears to be the first scientific evidence for the use of the spear, that they found a bear that was killed 35,000 years ago, I think in Russia, and this bear seems to have a spear hole in its head. And they are saying that this is the most likely explanation for this strange hole in the head of this animal, and it definitely does look like a spear hole. It's got that sort of shape. So this could be the first evidence for humans, and let's say whites, killing an animal using a spear 35,000 years ago. And then there's tens of thousands of years before that. I'm not sure exactly when we can say our race actually started. Where exactly were our ancestors? You know, at what point can we say that we were Europeans? And who knows, that might go back 100,000 years. I don't know for sure. But these are short periods of time, given the age of the earth and given what we know. And I used to be a creationist. I used to believe in the notion that there was some kind of godlike force. Even up until very recent times, I was very much a believer, literally in the same way that Hitler was, a believer in what you could call intelligent design, that this stuff could not exist without there being a God, that there's got to be some kind of being in charge. It's just too sophisticated. But I will tell you that little by little, I've become more and more of an atheist. Little by little, I've come to accept that, you know what, science is right on certain things. Science does have certain directions that are true. And it's taken me a long time to really look at it and say, you know, I think this evidence really is pretty strong. So I'm not a fan of Charles Darwin. I'm not a fan of Charles Darwin. I've never regarded him as somebody who was truly great. And interestingly enough, I have read that long before Charles Darwin, arguments along the same lines that Darwin was making had been made already for centuries. There were others who had already thought along these lines. But it was Charles Darwin who kind of finally put this thing together. And I do have other stuff that I discovered also that comes from science that actually shows that Charles Darwin wasn't by any means alone. That in actual fact, decades before Darwin came up with his ideas of evolution and survival of the fittest, that even decades before then, when science was dominated by Christians, and this is the shocking thing, is that a lot of science, a lot of atheist science, was inadvertently created by Christians. The way it worked was that there were lots of Christians who were Christian pastors, and they became learned men, and they wanted to understand the world that God had created. They wanted to understand God's creation. So they set out to go and study God's creation and to see the wondrous workings of God and how these things actually function. And in so doing, they themselves uncovered step by step the very things that would prove that, you know, there was no hand of God here at all. That in actual fact, things moved along by a series of laws. Now, I too at one time had the view that God didn't do everything, that rather God came along and God created the rules. God created the rules whereby the world lives. And so God is like the great lawgiver of the universe. He invents the law of gravity, he invents all these different things, and he basically builds a universe that's a machine. And this universe that's a machine then runs like a machine. So he doesn't have to be everywhere and he doesn't have to look at everything. Instead, the universe is a machine and it functions according to the will of its designer. So God can go to sleep and while he's asleep, the machine runs and the machine does its thing flawlessly. That is another way of looking at it. But nowadays, I don't believe in any of these things. But what I'm about to say anyway doesn't really impact it whether you do or don't believe in God, because at the end of the day, whether there is a God or isn't a God, the point is we have enough information to see how the world actually works. And we've got the evidence that goes back millions of years. And that evidence is good. Here and there, there are a few things you can question, but on the whole, that picture is more and more complete. And that picture merely adds to things that we can already see in our own lives. And even in the short period of human history, we can already even see proof of evolution. We can see proof of evolution. Humans and animals actually change at a hell of a fast rate. And one of the things that they can prove, for example, is that Europeans have grown in height by several centimeters in just a period of 200 years. The average white male has grown physically bigger. And it's a lot like the dinosaurs. They also grew bigger and bigger and bigger until big became a problem. But I must emphasize to you that the very basis of modern science, the very hardcore basis for all of modern atheist science was actually created by Christians, by hardcore believing Christians. And you can see it all over science. Even a guy like Sir Isaac Newton, who was an incredible man with his law of gravity and his proofs thereof and his calculations, even Isaac Newton was actually a biblical spiritual nutcase. He actually spent a lot of time trying to crack the Bible code. He believed that there was a code in the Bible and that you could break it mathematically, and he tried to crack the Bible code. You'll find all kinds of Christians actually came and laid the foundations for the non-Christianity that would follow. And it's not that they set out to do it deliberately. It's simply that when they got the evidence and they studied it properly and they invented their methods and they perfected their techniques, that they then discovered something that they didn't expect. And this happens a lot in our history, where we have concepts and we think we understand at a high level how things work. And then what happens is we study it at a lower level, and then we discover that the lower level actually violates the high level. This is something that happens often. And this is what happened with evolution. This is how evolution came into being. Is they set out to prove the workings of God, then they found all these dinosaurs, and then they began to realize there are other things going on, and they tried to start dating them. And as they logically went about their work, it was Christians who unwittingly went to prove that Christianity isn't true. They didn't set out to do it, but they laid the logical and proper foundations for it, and they were just doing honest scholarship. So long before Darwin existed, they already had begun to realize that there was a world of dinosaurs. The world of dinosaurs was already known by the early 1800s. They were already starting to figure out that dinosaurs had existed, that a whole age of strange creatures had existed before humans. They knew this decades before Darwin came along with his ideas. He just seems to have put together the proofs in a way that was more scientific, and by then so much evidence had accumulated, and he himself accumulated his own evidence, that he could now make his point. There are various weaknesses and discrepancies here and there. I used to actually study this a lot. I used to find anything that was anti-evolution. I've got books that are anti-evolution, real serious books that are anti-evolution that I bought, that I read from cover to cover, and I still have them. I still keep them, like I keep lots of my old stuff. And I know the arguments against evolution, but I will tell you, the preponderance of the evidence shows that other things are happening, and it gets very interesting. So let's take a look at the longest term knowledge that we have, the very longest term knowledge of survival and species, and is there anything we can learn? Is there something that we can learn about survival from animals and from nature? How does nature handle things? Alex Linder has said that most of the animals that have ever lived have died out. That 99.999% of animals that ever lived died out. And what will happen to us? And will we die out, or will we even mutate into something else? What is going to happen to humans? I myself have wondered whether Jews will evolve into, you know, rats with big heads or something, and they'll scurry away and hide in dark places. And then you'll have to go and send a message to a pest control guy and say to him, I've got a Jew infestation here. You know, will you be here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? You need to sort out my Jew problem. And what will we evolve into? And what can we do with ourselves? And I want to tell you, the more I look at these things, the more I think that very bizarre things could happen. Probably the best example of this is dinosaurs. Dinosaurs used to run around on the earth, and they were big creatures, and they were tough creatures, and they were very dangerous creatures, and they evolved into birds. And the evidence is very strong for that. And even the dinosaurs themselves, many types of dinosaurs, might actually have had feathers. Feathers might have been something dinosaurs had. Now, exactly how these processes of evolution take place and what exactly causes the one thing to lead to the other, it gets very interesting, and I don't think anybody is really clear on the matter. And even the issue of breeding and inheritance gets more and more complex the more they look at it. But there are some weird things that go on, and it makes for bizarre possibilities. I have wondered, for example, could we, let's say, create a type of human that can live in water? So you create a type of human that can swim and live underwater permanently. That human would be unable to live in air. Now, if you created an intelligent human that can live underwater permanently, what would that human be? So, let's say we took whites and we created an aquatic white, and the aquatic white could live underwater all the time. What would happen to that aquatic white? And that aquatic white may start building things underwater and creating a habitat underwater and a science underwater. And what happens if you leave them there? Will you, with time, get a type of white that would then also differ in opinion with you because the problems that they face underwater is different to the problems we face on land? Could we then part ways and have a war against each other because we now differ in viewpoints with each other? The same thing could happen with whites on other planets. You go and put whites on another planet and they start living there, what would happen? Would you get a repeat of what you had with colonialism, where the people who go and colonize then start differing with the people that they came from and they find themselves in conflict with each other? These things are very real and possible. And when it gets into space, it's going to get even wilder. But I personally think the future can be fantastic and will be fantastic, but it must be a future where we as a species function and move on to greater and greater things. I think impossible and insanely wild things are very possible. And science and logic does allow for it. It's very possible. It's very doable. But we've got other problems at the moment, and our problem is really a parasite problem. That's the real problem that we have currently that is threatening us. Our real threat is totally a parasite threat. That's what it is. So let's return to Charles Darwin. Let's take a look a little bit at some quotes that come from Darwin. To my knowledge, these are valid quotes from Darwin. I've never read Darwin, I've never followed him in detail, so I can't be totally certain, but these seem to be valid quotes that come from him. So let's take a look at what do we know from hundreds of millions of years of life. What is millions? When you get into millions of years of existence, what do we learn from that? Now, keep in mind, we are mammals, and as mammals, we've only been around for a limited period of time. So, according to science, the earliest mammals that came on Earth were 178 million years ago. But the earliest monkeys came into the world about 5 to 23 million years ago. And when did the earliest humans appear? So, according to scientists, they believe that the earliest humans lived 315,000 years ago. So, mammals, and we are mammals, appeared 178 million years ago. And then a type of monkey-like species appeared between 5 and 23 million years ago, and the first human types of creatures appeared 300,000 years ago. And we know that we occupied Europe for 40 to 45,000 years. So we probably, as a more recent species, we probably appeared somewhere in the last 100,000 years or so. But what does millions of years of evolution teach us? So we're going to take a close look at this. We're going to look at some things. And we're first going to start off with the monkey types, because the monkey types are relatively recent and we are related to these monkey or pre-monkey types. That is another point, is that according to scientists, we aren't directly descended from monkeys per se. We are descended from a pre-monkey, a monkey ancestor. There was a common ancestor that we shared. So that doesn't mean that we are related to chimpanzees directly, that we evolved from chimpanzees. It's simply that chimpanzees had an ancestor and we had the same ancestor. That's all. So it's not to say that we come from chimpanzees and gorillas. No, it's that we share a common ancestor that's even older. So what I want to show you first of all is junk science, a little bit of junk science. This comes from Britain, and this, in my view, is junk science. This is rubbish science. This is garbage science. And if we look at Charles Darwin, and here is one quote that seems to be from Charles Darwin. It seems to be a valid quote. And the quote is, "In the long history of humankind and animal kind too, those who learn to collaborate and improvise most effectively have prevailed." So here he gives two concepts, collaboration and improvisation, that if you collaborate and you improvise, that's how you manage to win. So I don't have a problem with that. And perhaps the deeper discussion for whites is, what levels of collaboration do you need in order to survive? What levels exactly do you need? And I will tell you that the first, most important, and highest level of collaboration that must be attained is whites collaborating with other whites. That is the first and highest and most preeminent form of collaboration. And that form of collaboration must not be allowed to be destroyed or harmed in any way whatsoever. And that is where Jews are moving in and are totally fucking it up for whites. That's where Jews have come and caused tremendous problems for us. But let us take a look at a bit of junk science from Britain. And I regard this as junk science. This is my personal opinion. These two scientists are coming and they're going to tell you a story about monkeys. And they're going to tell you about different types of monkeys, chimpanzees and bonobos. And scientists, there are quite a few scientists who've gotten a love of these bonobos, okay? And these are another type of monkey that seem to be related to chimpanzees. And the bonobos have been studied, and all kinds of wonderful lessons have come out from these bonobos. So listen to these two scientists talking and telling you what they believe is the lesson from this, and what whites, or humans in their term, what humans can learn from these bonobos. And I'm going to show you some other things afterwards. So listen to this British modern junk science, in my view.
When it comes to Darwin, we did absolutely misunderstand survival of the fittest. Fitness is just your ability to reproduce. So this idea that you had to be the biggest and the strongest and the meanest in order to succeed, it's not what Darwin meant at all.
Survival of the fittest and its misconstrual has been extremely harmful. The idea was used as a political platform to justify and to rally people, to have people feel threatened and to have them agree to things that when you look at history, you cannot understand how people would have agreed.
We see it in eugenics, the eugenics policies. We can see it now in how we are dealing with the pandemic. The idea that because it affects people who are elderly, then maybe that's just the natural law. The way that survival of the fittest as it's being interpreted in to be the alpha male will make you the most successful is not actually how it goes. It doesn't go that way in nature and it doesn't go that way in the corporate environment as well. What people don't understand is that it's actually very costly to be the alpha male. It can be incredibly stressful. You're always looking over your shoulder.
Chimpanzees are famous for being quite friendly and social, but they also have a darker side. They kill each other and they do it systematically. Bonobos have never been seen to kill another bonobo. What is it about their psychology that allows them to be that way? We know that bonobos evolved south of the Congo River, and we think that's because they were isolated. They actually were able to form friendships, especially females could form friendships in a way that chimpanzee females could not. They lived in a richer environment and it was easier to hang out and share food and raise babies together. And because they were friends, they don't put up with male aggression. So you have males no longer being selected for this aggressiveness, but instead friendliness wins the day. The friendliest males were the ones that had the most offspring because the females preferred them.
If any male bonobo starts acting like a chimpanzee, the females will join together and sort of correct him. We would be so much better off if we could learn from the bonobos. Even more than bonobos, I think that we, the Homo sapiens, are the best example of what survival of the friendliest is, because we existed with at least four other human species in the last 100,000 years. And so what was it that allowed us to succeed? And the usual answer is, oh, we were smarter, we had bigger brains. None of those things are true, because over the years we found that Neanderthals, they had brains that were at least as big as ours. They had culture, they had a similar technology, they were stronger.
How come they're all dead? So we think it must have been something else. So then we started to look at morphological traits that are associated in other species with selection for friendliness. And we found evidence for those in our own species in the last 50,000 years that basically humans have friendly faces. We have shorter faces, narrower faces. We don't have these giant brow ridges that other human species have. Those are all traits that you would expect if we had experienced selection for friendliness. So we're the friendliest species that evolved. We recognize complete strangers as potential group mates. As long as they have a marker of identity, we all kind of agree on within our group, whether it's an accent or something we wear, or maybe even how we prepare food.
But the flip side of this is that when we feel that our group is threatened by an outside group, we are able to be extremely violent and cruel towards them. We almost do not see them as human.
So then the question is, how do we immunize ourselves to prevent that off switch from going off? And I think there's a couple of things we can do. The first is to celebrate democracy with all her flaws. And the second thing is to help facilitate friendships across different groups, to allow people to sort of wake up from dehumanizing ways and rehumanize and see everyone as equal.
So what you've got here is modern British Jewish junk propaganda masquerading as science. And one of the scientists is a woman, which already means that there's a bias, there's a female bias of, oh no, we got to live in peace, we got to love each other, blah, 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 all that kind of junk, okay? Instead of just looking at it in its raw form, the way that it is. So the real question is, what did Darwin actually mean when he said survival of the fittest? Many people take that to mean the survival of the strongest. But then the question becomes, what is strength? And this actually also has a military application, I must tell you. There's a military answer to this as well. And a key thing is that in evolution, as in nations, is that there is competition. That competition is the key element. So what exactly is survival of the fittest? Is it the physically strongest who just get to beat the others down, or is there more to it? In the military world, people tend to think that the military answer is the same thing, that it's just strength, just raw strength, but it's actually not. And that's a separate topic for military videos that I want to get back to. That there are two aspects to warfare. The one has to do with the physical ability to kill, but there are a lot more angles to it. In fact, one could even say that there are three angles to it. There's a leadership and higher level strategic intellectual level. Then there's a technical scientific engineering level. And then there's the actual soldier who's got the tool that he's using. But there are probably three different aspects to warfare. And warfare is the ultimate competition. They don't tell you this, but this is the ultimate form of competition. And of course, these British scientists don't mention that. But what exactly is survival of the fittest? And let's take a look at what these British scientists say. They now come up with a junk liberal interpretation of survival of the fittest, which I think is just rubbish. So in some respects, they're knocking Darwin, but I don't know exactly what Darwin himself had said. I only have these quotes, which his quotes don't seem to disprove certain things. And I think his quotes are valid. So one thing that she does raise, this woman scientist, she raises the issue of ability to reproduce. She says that ability to reproduce is the most important of survival of the fittest. That could well be one of the angles. And reproduction is something we will discuss regarding whites. That is a huge area of weakness. So I won't disagree with her on the importance of reproduction. Reproduction is critically, critically important. And it's, in my view, the area where whites have made the biggest mistake. But there's more to it than just that. So according to the scientists, Darwin had said that there is this process of natural selection. And later, this was reworded as survival of the fittest. So he said natural selection, that there is some form of selection that takes place. So they say that scientists have reinterpreted this as the strong versus the weak. So where you immediately begin to see that there's a political agenda is the next thing is, the pictures of these Nazis, and these Nazis are evil, and this was all wrong. It wasn't about the strong versus the weak, and it led to great errors, and off they go. And it's immediately all about the Nazis. And this misinterpretation led to all these problems and to, you know, basically the Nazis and Hitler. However, that is total rubbish, because the Nazis were very much naturalists, and they looked at nature in its proper form, and they studied science and the philosophies related to that very deeply. So now here are these British, this was wrong. If you want to say the Nazis were wrong, then you have to say the Roman Empire was wrong. You have to say that all pre-Christian history of whites is wrong. That the actions of the Vikings is wrong. That the actions of the Celts and the Gauls is wrong. It's all bunk, man. It's all bunk. It's a political message masquerading as science. Right there, straight off, BBC bullshit. Straight out of the starting gate. And then they go on and they say, eugenics is so evil, you know. Oh God, eugenics. Hey, eugenics. That's an excellent thing. It's an excellent thing. Eugenics is what every cattle farmer and horse breeder and dog breeder and fish breeder and scientists do. Why wouldn't it work for humans? It will work for humans. It'll work for whites. So, you know, this is immediately an attack on the Germans and that kind of thinking. An attempt to deflect you away from what should be working and what is logical. And then it's about Auschwitz, literally. You see the people in the concentration camps, that's so inhuman, blah, blah, blah. What does this have to do with science? But anyway, they're basically trying to discredit it. And that's the thrust of this thing. This thing is political. And then it's like, we're doing it in the pandemic. We're doing it wrong in the pandemic. Rubbish, man. And then this woman scientist attacks the whole alpha male thing. You know, to be the alpha male, you don't have to be the alpha male. It's so stressful. Man, these people are morons. They're either morons or Jews have paid them or the British government has paid them to come and do a bunch of propaganda. Or the BBC, which is an anti-white communist freaking outfit itself. So then they go on about the alpha male. It's costly, you're always looking over your shoulder, it's so stressful. But hey, there are men who've wanted it and men who've done it with energy and with a desire for it. And why can't that be an option for those who want it? Yes, we know all those things and even more, but there are times when people want that. And it brings its benefits to society. Hitler was an alpha male. Napoleon was an alpha male. Caesar was an alpha male. Lots of alpha males. And there are many things that they bring that are good and fantastic and awesome that wouldn't be here if they weren't alpha males. But no, who must we learn from? We must learn from the bonobos, the bonobo monkeys. So, then they go on and they talk about chimpanzees, that chimpanzees can be friendly, but chimpanzees can also kill systematically. But the bonobos, no, bonobos have never been seen to kill another bonobo. So here's the kicker about the bonobos. Why are the bonobos different to the chimpanzees? Turns out that these scientists say the bonobos are isolated and they live in a richer environment. And when they live in a richer environment, then they can kick back and chill. And basically, when they live in a richer environment, then they don't have to engage in all these other activities, like the chimpanzees do. So it turns out that these bonobos basically have an easy life. And because they have an easy life, now they do all kinds of things that are different. And the females behave differently, and the females have more power, and the males are dominated and controlled by the females. Not always dominated, but the females control the behavior of the males. So these are lazy monkeys, basically, that have an easy life. Well, if you go back into evolution and you go and look at what makes whites different from blacks, scientists have been debating this for a long time. And one of the theories that is quite well established out there is that the people who lived in Africa, the people who we now later come to call the blacks, they lived in a much easier environment in which you can live. But the Europeans and also other Asians lived in an icy hell, and they had to struggle intensely for everything, including food. And that they attribute our brain evolution to the harder environment we lived in. So basically, the difference between Europeans and Africans has to do with the difficulty of your environment. That Europeans living in an icy hell, and we'll return to that icy hell, Europeans who live in a totally isolated icy hell on Earth, they were forced to evolve differently. And that is where our brain capacity comes from. But the lazy ones who didn't go anywhere, they didn't evolve either because life was so much easier. So the difference that you have between the chimpanzees and the bonobos is basically the difference that you have between Europeans and blacks. It's a softer form of that difference, but there it is. Though these scientists are now, let's be like the bonobos, let's not be like the chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are also natural, and the chimpanzees are clearly having a harder time, and they are nastier, but that's what makes them live. And so they go on an anti-male thing here. Because there's no aggression, the females basically control male behavior, blah, blah, blah. Now we're into an anti-male story. Be like the bonobos. So they go on to tell you that if a bonobo male starts behaving like a chimpanzee, the females will gather together and put him in his place. The bonobo that has the most babies is the friendliest one. I could have thrown up when the female scientist said, we could be so much better off if we could live to be like the bonobos. Here she is, a white woman. She herself is descended from whites who had to struggle and survive and fight and claw their way forward through life. And here she is, idiot and moron that she is, and she's busy telling you how, wouldn't we be better off if we were like the bonobos? She herself, a beneficiary of that very same environment that she now is criticizing. And then she heads off into a direction that I don't know where the hell she picked this up. Humans, we are the best example of survival of the friendliest. Now please, show me anywhere in freaking history, anywhere in any history of the world at any time in the near past, the distant past, and any point in between. Please, for God's sake, show me where friendliest won the day. No, it never won the day. It was all about teamwork, survival, sticking together, fighting it out against other groups. There never was a time where humans, especially whites, just sat and loafed around and everybody just came to them and was friendly to them. They were competing with others. with other races, with other species of humans, and they were competing viciously with each other. Our history is a history of nothing but the most intensive competition you can find. And here she is saying, oh God, you know, humans, Homo sapiens, we are the best example of survival of the friendliest. Please, please, show me this. Show me this. Where is this? I don't see any of this anywhere. I've never seen this in history. So then she goes on and talks about the fact that we coexisted with other human species, the Neanderthals, etc. Then she goes and she knocks them and says, well, we didn't have bigger brains, we weren't stronger, we weren't this, we weren't that, but why did we survive? So then the question is, okay, so here are the Neanderthals, they match us on most things and even beat us on things like strength, so why did they survive? And now they look at the thing and they liken us to a dog, and they say, well, it's because we were friendlier. So then the scientist goes on to say he thinks that we survived on the basis of friendliness. However, I must tell you, if you read our history and you look at our history, I don't see where that friendliness comes, unless it's friendliness inside the tribe or whatever, but you can go and see the violence that constitutes our history. I have an encyclopedia of military history, and it looks at military history for the last 2,500 or so years. And even any encyclopedia, you can just go into any encyclopedia, just go and look at lists of wars, rising and falling of nations. You will see incessant turmoil. Turmoil is a part of our history. It is a never-ending thing. And that is a sign of competition. Go and look at how many kings there were, leaders there were, and then kings who tried to overthrow other kings, leaders who tried to crush each other. This is history. It goes on intensely. Though these scientists do admit that, yes, we do have a darker side, and they show us blowing up people in the Middle East, you know, wars for Israel. So they do admit that, you know, we're not such friendly people after all, and actually we've never been. And then they launch into a whole multiracial, multicultural thing about how friendly we are and how we acknowledge others, and off we go, we will find potential mates from others. Immediately a non-white view of reality. So they do admit that when our group is threatened, that we are nasty. Well, that is how we are. And we defend our group and we kill anything that we need to kill. And then these scientists immediately start saying, oh goodness, why do we need to do this violence? We need to immunize ourselves from this nasty behavior that results in killing. Hold on. If you were a true scientist with truly logical views, you would not be saying things like that. What you would really be doing is you'd be asking the question. You would ask the question, is it better to be friendly or is it better to defend your group? You would ask many, many deeper questions. But these two clowns are just like, you know, anything that like that, you know, where we are cruel to others and we behave like this when our group is threatened. No, that's wrong. We must stop that switch from going off. Hey, that's not scientific. That's not logical. That is not what you would determine if you were studying nature seriously. You're coming here with a preconceived notion. You're starting to say, oh, that's behavior that we must stop. They are basically telling you, oh, when our group is threatened, When our group is threatened, we do all these nasty things in defense of our group. And guess what? We need to find out how to stop doing those things when our group is threatened. That's what they're freaking telling you. That's not scientific, my friends. That is not scientific. That is not logical. That is total bollocks, that. If you were looking at the situation of our group is under threat, you would not be talking nonsense like that. You would also be asking questions, why do we do that behavior? They already know that that behavior comes when our group is threatened. And you need to just simply say, is this behavior good for us or bad for us? Should we do it that way? Should we do more of it or less of it? That is how you'd operate if you were truly logical. These two, they've got preconceived plans here, and they are operating like a bunch of liberals, misinterpreting science, misinterpreting history, and coming up and talking this bunch of crap. Oh, how do we stop the switch from going off? After having told you that the switch goes off when your group is under threat. What the hell is that? You acknowledge that the group is under threat, and then you say, oh no, the problem is not that the group is under threat. The problem is that we react in a certain way when our group is under threat, and suddenly, oh no, stop that. Stop reacting that way. It doesn't say, oh, the group is under threat, you need to deal with the threat. No, they're saying, oh, the group is under threat, stop the defensive reaction when you're under threat. That's what we need to stop. That's a lot of bollocks, okay? That's a lot of bollocks right there, slipping it right under your nose. But as they continue, you can see that they've got an agenda, man. They've got a political agenda, and they're trying to fakely massage science and history into their junk agenda. Then the guy says, oh, we must celebrate democracy with all her flaws. Oh, we must leave that system as is with all its flaws. Excuse me, where the hell did democracy come from? I didn't see Darwin talking about democracy. I didn't see any studies of bonobos and chimpanzees showing democracy. All of a sudden it's, oh no, we must use democracy and accept it with all its flaws. Where the hell is the science for that, please? And then it says, the next thing is to facilitate friendships across different groups. By the way, neither the chimpanzees nor the bonobos actually have that either. Everything that the scientists are talking about is in group. It is about how chimpanzees behave among each other, how bonobos behave among each other. What is this now? See, they are twisting science. They are starting to draw conclusions that have got no basis even in their own research. But hey, they're putting it out there. And then you suddenly see all the different humans, and you'll see Jews in there, in their picture. All of a sudden, they are trying to use science to tell you, no, this is the solution. But this isn't even in their own science. It's not like bonobos and gorillas are busy having a love fest and time of their lives. That's not even related. But here they are trying to expand that into the human version of that. And then they come and say, rehumanize and see everybody as equal. Hold on. Where's that? Where's that in your science? There's nothing in there that supports that notion. I don't even know if that even exists among the bonobos. It definitely doesn't exist among other animals. Other animals have got pack leaders, pride leaders. They have got their alpha males. And when you have alpha males, you don't have an equal society. You've got a hierarchic structure, even amongst monkeys, gorillas, etc. So it ends with other humans who, by the way, this is a separate topic, but other human beings that are alive today if the rules of science were applied right now, we would not be talking about a single human species. We'd be talking about multiple human species. Multiple human species. They are trying to take science and pretend all kinds of things that don't exist. This is pure propaganda. Some weak science masquerading as pure propaganda. And this based on an abnormal group of chimpanzees called bonobos, taking the abnormal and trying to pretend that somehow that relates to us. Somehow now saying, oh well, there are all these other chimpanzees all across Africa and they're violent and they're nasty, and then there's this secluded, different group who live in a particularly good place, and they act like a bunch of idiots, and we need to be like them. I'm afraid the science does not match up with that. This whole thing from the BBC, this is total propaganda and a total misrepresentation of the way life is. Now let me show you something different. Let me show you another story of evolution. So now let's get on with the business of reality and take a look at what reality actually teaches you. So here's another quote from Darwin. And in this one, Darwin says, "In the struggle for survival, the fittest win out at the expense of their rivals because they succeed in adapting themselves best to their environment." So in this quote, he's not talking about collaboration. In this quote, he talks about adaption. So in the previous quote, he'd spoken about collaboration and improvisation. Here, he talks about the fittest surviving because they adapt to their environment. So he's saying the fittest win out at the expense of their rivals because they succeed in adapting themselves best. So he's talking about adaption, and you can read into that improvisation, because improvisation is part of adaption. And he also talks about at the expense of their rivals. At the expense of their rivals. In other words, there are winners and there are losers. There are losers. And the losers in evolution, they die. The losers die. So we're going to take a look at a little video. This video was not compiled as a propaganda piece. This video was something that someone put together. And the video was about ants. Have you had an ant problem? Have you struggled to get rid of ants? Then you've already had an interaction with ants and known that they may be tiny, but they're pretty tough. And according to this video, ants are the oldest species of insect. And ants have been around for 100 million years. 100 million years. Now, 100 million years ago, there were dinosaurs. There were mammals, and there were dinosaurs. And all the dinosaurs are now gone, except for those that adapted and turned into birds. And lots of mammals have disappeared in that 100 million years. However, ants are still around. And notice we're talking 100 million years. This is far longer than the time that humans have been around, and it's even longer than chimpanzees and monkeys have been around. So ants have survived and outlived even the dinosaurs. And the dinosaurs themselves were no slouches. The dinosaurs were around for hundreds of millions of years. They lived and thrived and succeeded on the face of the earth for a very, very long time. So ants have coexisted with dinosaurs, ants have coexisted with mammals, and ants have outlived lots and lots and lots of things. But they're just tiny little creatures. And what is their secret? What is their secret? How have they managed to survive 100 million years? Well, let us learn from the ants and take a look at this video. And right at the beginning of this video, you'll see ants and crabs. Take special note of what happened between the ants and the crabs, and I'll discuss the rest of it after the video.
This is the Christmas Island red crab. Yes, one of those that fill the entire island during the migrations. But it will be over very soon. Red crabs will be destroyed by ants. Since 1990, ants have killed more than 50 million of crabs, which is 40% of the total amount. USA, Spain, Japan. Nobody was ready for an invasion like this. This footage shows ants ransacking wasps' nests completely, killing all the wasps and taking away everything. And this case isn't an exception. It happens all the time. It seems weird, but an ant is able to easily defeat a wasp that can be several times larger. And what about the sting? The sting is useless, because the ants have their own. This is a legacy from an ancient ancestor. Yes, ants and wasps are distant relatives, in some way. Ant sting is thinner than human hair, and during the attack is directed to the victim's body to inject venom. In addition, they have powerful jaws and acid, so this wasp just doesn't have any chance. But why do ants kill wasps? Why do they destroy their nests? Wasps are very aggressive predators. We can't say that they're pleasant neighbors. And to resolve the problem, ants have to deal not only with adult wasps. There's nothing complicated about it. They do the same thing with Avondale spiders. Mermicia ants reach the spider's nest, kill the smallest ones, and kick the mother and the others. And then they destroy the nest. Yes, they do everything so that spiders leave and never come back. The reason is very simple. These creatures feed at the same time in the same territory. Ants don't need competitors, and it's easier to get rid of spiders while they're small. Well, I don't think that size and age is a problem for ants. If they want, they can kill anyone. They need only to come together in a large group. There's a common water snake captured and almost eaten alive.
He's still alive. My goodness, this is terrible. He's a big one. Look how big he is.
Or, for example, another snake that was also unlucky to meet ants. Ants need only few hours to eat a whole gecko, or as I said, a rather big spider. Just give ants enough time to do it, they have all the other resources. But how could it be that such small creatures have such an arsenal of weapons? And all this doesn't contradict any laws of nature? Not really. Ants are the most ancient insects. They existed even more than 100 million years ago. And of course, all this time, they had to fight to survive. They fought so much and so often that it was very important to their evolution. And it doesn't matter that many enemies just died out during this time. For example, in the distant past, the main enemies of ancient ants were dinosaurs, birds, and mammals. At that time, ants were able to use their powerful stings, but it was useless against the other insects. Then their sting was transformed into a chemical delivery system that could be used against other ants. Jaws also help a lot. Some ants are able to explode and spray everything around them with a sticky substance. Others can spit at their enemies. It seems 2 million years more and ants would invent guns. It's similar to the development of the artificial intelligence. There are many examples how it not only learned during the game, but is also able to find a flaw in the system. Yes, even today, the artificial intelligence can hack a simple game and find a way to break the rules. And not so much time has passed since its creation, it isn't surprising that the ants could do 100 times more. This is an ordinary ant colony. And this, okay, this is also a colony. It belongs to the Argentine ants. Initially, they lived in the subtropics of South America. But at the beginning of the 21st century, they were found also in South Africa, the Mediterranean, Australia, New Zealand, and California. This is a real disaster. In a new territory, Argentine ants begin to destroy all local ants of any species. Their purpose is to form a huge megacolony. It means that insects that live in different colonies are genetic relatives. Well, it's like when you moved out of your parents' house, but you still live next door. According to scientists, a big number of this population is comparable only to human society. And you know what? These colonies continue to grow. I wonder what other insects feel when they see such an army of orcs. I wanted to say of Argentine ants. Do they understand that there's no Gandalf to save them? Are they horrified? Ah, we'll all die soon. Okay, let's keep working. It's hard to believe that insects have feelings, and it's even harder to study this question, but scientists are trying to do it. For example, they experimented with the Drosophilidae flies, trying to cause them a primal fear of predators. And it seems like they succeeded. Frightened flies needed some time to calm down and return to eating. So they felt something. Therefore, other insects also may be afraid of Argentine ants. Perhaps they already have developed something like a phobia. And it would be logical in contrast to the human fear of insects. What can they do to us, really? Insects are tiny. Well, most of them. Insectophobia, or a fear of insects, probably has different reasons. Some insect bites.
Oh, help!
Some of them carry disease or could envenom you. Anyone wants to stay away from these insects. But what about the harmless butterfly? It's possible that it doesn't cause fear, only disgust. The human brain has learned to equalize these emotions with time, and probably this is because of the anatomy. Insect bodies are so much different than animals' or birds' bodies, and it's scary. It's not a surprise that insects are used in horror films, even ants. In fact, any small creature will seem scary if you make it 100 times bigger, no to mention this terrifying sound. First news is that it really sounds like an ant. Second news is that, in fact, this real voice sounds even scarier. Ants communicate using pheromones, but it doesn't mean that they do it silently. Moreover, their voices are different depending on their position in the colony. This, for example, is the voice of an ordinary working ant. And this one is a soldier. And finally, the queen. It's amazing how in 1954, the filmmakers were able to guess ant intonations. Would real ants be scared if they had seen their huge copy? It's hard to say. Apparently, ants, as well as animals, don't have an abstract fear of death. They aren't afraid to cease to exist. They are afraid only of the things that can kill them. For example, they can be afraid of one particular predator, and it's really different from human perception. In most cases, we're alarmed by everything connected with the conception of death, especially if these things are human remains. One of the most terrifying crypts in human history is located directly under Paris. There are bones of approximately 6 million of people from Parisian cemeteries. The purpose was to free cemeteries, so the bones were piled in the catacombs. Only a few years later, people began to organize bones and skulls in a special way. And you know what? Now it looks even scarier. Today, this realm of death is something like a museum of the history of Paris and people who live there. And it seems like there's nothing strange about it. But what if I say that ants have something similar? Only one species, Formica archiboldi. Even scientists call its behavior strange. These ants not only hunt other ants, not only eat them, but also collect their skulls. Yes, there are a lot of skulls of the Odontomachus ants in their nests. They just lie in there. Scientists don't have any idea why these ants collect only skulls. Probably they like all this French atmosphere.
Bonjour.
There's a theory that ants just don't know that they have to get rid of their murdered enemies. Well, they are sloppy, but they know that dead bodies have to be removed from their anthills. This way they'd avoid infection. This behavior is called necrophoresis. It's typical for social insects like bees and termites. And there are even undertakers in ant colonies that deal with the dead. Usually they put them in a special tomb inside the anthill or throw them out. If the undertaker finds an ant with the smell of the dead, this insect will be immediately removed from the colony. By the way, if you put this smell on a living insect, it'll be killed and thrown out, just in case. And now I tell you one thing that surprised me a lot. Ants understand that the contact with the dead is dangerous because it can provoke disease. But insects can't wash their paws and they don't have personal protective equipment. So this is why the undertakers are trying to remain social distance to not infect the others. They spend a lot of time outside the anthill, or they try to remain outside while others are inside. But ants know not only how to bury the dead, they also know how to heal the living. and they don't need to use human synthetic substances for that. Sometimes nature does it all by itself. During the American Civil War, doctors noticed that many of the soldiers' wounds were glowing with a greenish-blue glow. Glowing wounds were healing faster and scars were less noticeable. Can you imagine this? Everything was dirty, insanitary. There were many insects and people miraculously were healing. This phenomenon was called angel's glow. Many years later, scientists discovered that no angels were involved in treatment, but there was bacteria, Photohabdus luminescens. The chemical substances from these bacteria killed all other bacteria, therefore they had antibiotics effect. The ants' antibiotics work the other way. Wait a minute, I said ants' antibiotics? What? Yes, ants have not only the undertakers, but also chemists. Somehow they learned how to collect resin and mix it with the acid they produce themselves. After that, chemists put this mixture all over the anthill. According to the scientists, the composition destroys deadly fungus and protects the colony from epidemics. Each anthill has its own Heisenberg. Well, and Jesse Pinkman, I guess.
Yeah, Mr. White. Yes, science.
See you later.
So let's go back to that video, and what did we see in the video? First up, the crabs versus the ants. Tiny, teeny weeny ants, and they've destroyed 50 million crabs. So unlike bonobos, who are a teeny weeny group of monkeys who live in ease in a very specific part of Africa, ants are everywhere. Ants live on every continent, in every place, under all conditions, and ants are fine and they thrive. And they can handle any situation. So here are these teeny weeny ants, and they kill 40% of the crabs on that island when the crabs are busy migrating and doing their thing. These tiny little ants kill an animal that is many times bigger than them. They don't run away and hide from the crabs. They kill crabs, which technically they shouldn't be able to do. But the reality is they do. So the next piece is about ants taking on wasp nests. They go in and they ransack the whole place and they kill everything. So these ants go and they absolutely genocide the wasps. They wipe out all the wasps and they steal everything. And it turns out that even though ants are very distantly related to wasps, and wasps are many times bigger than the ants still kill the wasps. They can even fight them, it seems, one-on-one, even though the creature that they're fighting against is many times bigger than them. So again, the ants shouldn't be winning, but they do win. So the ants have got several mechanisms to kill with, including stings, as well as their normal jaws. So the wasps themselves are no slouches. The wasps themselves are killers and predators, but ants outplay them at the same game. So when the ants have to face up to spiders, the ants do preemptive killing. They kill the spiders when the spiders are babies, and they exterminate them that way. So the ants not only kill the baby spiders first, they then get rid of the adults, they wipe out the nest, they totally genocide the spiders. So these ants are genociding the wasps. They're genociding the spiders. They don't muck around. So it turns out that in nature, these spiders are direct competitors for food with the ants. And what do the ants do? They go and they exterminate them so that they don't have competition. The ants are wiping out other insects that can be competition for them in their territory. So ants are the epitome of teamwork. They're not afraid of anything, size doesn't matter, ants will win. Ants will try to kill anything, including living snakes. Ants are omnivores, which means that they eat vegetation as well as animals and meat, and they kill and eat whatever the hell they want. So as the guy in the video tells you, ants are the most ancient insects, and they've had more than 100 million years that they've existed, and they've had to fight to survive, and they've become freaking good at it. And some of their enemies also just died out through time. But whatever happened, ants always lived, and ants had a system that makes them live and makes them survive when others don't. And I must admit, I was laughing when the guy said, the ants have got so many different weapons, give them 2 million years more and they'd invent guns. And then you've got the Argentine ants that just go everywhere and they'll kill even other ants and they will dominate and push others out. Again, genocide, death, but they inhabit, they keep, and it's theirs. So no talk of friendly faces here. Here it's genocide, competition, fight to survive, outlive anybody, fight anybody, see to it that you win. That's 100 million years of evolution. Interestingly enough, ants have got soldiers and workers. That is something that you don't see often in animal societies, but ants have got this definite classification. So these ant colonies are very sophisticated organizations, almost like human cities and human societies, and they've even got specialized jobs with undertakers and chemists. So ants are an exceptional example of teamwork. Ants are a fantastic team, and they work as a community, and they work and they thrive and function as a community, and they deal with their workload as well as their threats as a single unit. So let's return to Charles Darwin, to another quote from Charles Darwin, and it says, one general law leading to the advancement of all organic beings, namely, multiply, vary, let the strongest live and the weakest die. So, I gotta tell you, however those British tried to twist Charles Darwin's words, Darwin at a point does say, let the strongest live and the weakest die. But I suppose you could argue, what does he mean by the strongest? But I don't think that it's that cryptic. It does imply some kind of level of health. I would think that some kind of level of health, if you could use that term, is a valid term. But the rules are simple. Multiply, you must multiply. Vary, and that can also be used and interpreted as adapt, improvise. He himself has said that. And then, let the strongest live and the weakest die. And that is the basic law of nature, that the organic creatures must multiply, they must vary, they must adapt, and let the strongest live and the weakest die. Now, I don't mean to say that that is the mechanism that we're going to apply among whites, that we go and we kill off the weakest whites. But we should see ourselves like the ants, like those colonies of ants. We too are colonies. Those colonies may be nations or whatever, but we need to keep our colonies healthy, and also our colonies need to expand as well. That's something else about nature. Ben Clausen, the creator of the Church of Creativity, who's a guy who I have a lot of respect for, And I do want to do more stuff to do with him as well. I've got so many ideas, so little time. But Ben Clarkson also spoke about the need for whites to multiply. And he said, whites must multiply and colonize. That is healthy. And we used to do that. We used to do that a lot. Now, the reason that you need to vary and adapt is because the situation itself changes. The threats change. And we now, in our current state, have got threats that are different to the threats we had in the past. I would describe our threats as parasitic threats, actually. Our current problem of whites everywhere is a parasitic problem. We are actually being inundated by parasites, human parasites, who are actually destroying us. They are living off of us and destroying us in the process. The parasites are getting the upper hand. Our real problem is a parasitic problem, actually. It's come from our other successes, but now our parasites are a problem for us. And our parasites are also, in part, competitors for us. And if you looked, you would have seen that the ants destroy competition. They wipe them out. They even wipe them out preemptively. They are ruthless, and they come out on top. So this is a much wider view of the world. It's a view of a creature that has lived more than 100 million years. This creature lives all across the earth, thrives all across the earth, and it's very different to the weak, pathetic example of the handful of bonobos in a very special part of Africa. As for chimpanzees and other animals, it is very possible that as they try to explain away this killing behavior, it is very possible that they are ignoring the fact that the chimpanzees may be moving into a higher state. The chimpanzees are actually evolving into a higher level, and at a higher level, you have reasons to kill. Not just killing for food, but you kill for other reasons as well. And that is why all these liberals and others, when they start saying, oh, you know, there's this terrible side of whites and it's a wrong side, etc. No, no. This could be the normal result of evolution. And I want to expand on that because take, for example, the concept of aliens. Many people who believed in aliens have indicated, oh, won't it be great if the aliens come to the earth? Aliens will help us. Now, I myself, when I believed in aliens and life after death and traveling through space, etc., I also used to think, oh, goodness, won't it be wonderful to meet the aliens? We're going to have so many great conversations and we're going to learn so much from them. You know something? Maybe you don't want to meet aliens, because when I look at life and evolution, I really don't see any reason why we should be happy to meet aliens. Because in order for them to survive and to be able to compete successfully and to get into space and to travel and meet up with us at some point, they themselves would have to be survivors. They themselves would have to be tough. It is very unlikely that you would find some kind of alien who comes from a planet, let's call it the soft planet, and they manage to evolve on this soft planet, and then they go out into space and they believe in junk. I don't think that that will be the norm. I think the reality will be that any animal that reaches any kind of level of sophistication will, as part of its natural set of responses, also be willing to kill. and they themselves will have a means of recognizing threats to their society, to their group, and they will respond to those threats, and they too will be killers. So I must tell you that I think if it came down to the issue of competing for planetary space and we had to meet up with aliens, that those aliens, if they see that we're a threat, I don't think they'll hesitate for a second to try to kill us. They won't come and say, oh, let's get around the fire and sing Kumbaya together. They'll say, hey, here's another animal. This is a dangerous animal. We must kill it. Let's kill it now. So the opening round won't be, hi, can I come and trade with you? I'm looking for spices or gold or whatever. It's going to be, here come the missiles and they're going to nuke your ass off or do something like that, that you won't even know what hits you. I think that that is what they are more likely to be like, and that any advanced society that should evolve anywhere in space, at any place, especially as it gets stronger, it will only tolerate you if you are no threat to it. And if they are so incredibly superior to you that they look on you as easy meat, and they might tolerate you maybe for a bit of fun, but I don't see that they're going to be in any way kindly or nice, or that they will have any kinds of concepts that we have and that we've produced, especially under Christianity. I'm telling you that I don't see that being the norm. They will come, and if they see that you are a danger in some way, they will destroy you, man. They won't muck around. I don't think that you really want to meet aliens. I think that meeting aliens would be quite something. Plus, these days, when I look at the whole setup, I will tell you, I don't think there are many alien species at all. That we might find that we have entire galaxies of billions of stars that we could move through without any problem. But at some point, there might be somebody we'll run into. I think, though, that the majority of the universe is quite empty and dead, at least in terms of life as we understand it. We will not easily come across others that match us. We might find that we've got at least this galaxy and maybe many others that we can do in whatever we want. But that is also something that I want to discuss later, because I believe that there's no reason why we can't have an unbelievably awesome future, a future so awesome beyond all imagination. But I don't think it's going to be one of friendly faces. I don't think aliens are going to look at our friendly faces and say, oh, we feel sorry for them, let them live. I don't think so, man. They'll either kill you or chain you up or experiment with you or even torture you for fun. I really, really don't see that there is anything out there except more of the same of life on Earth. Life on Earth is vicious, it's competitive, it's brutal. And out in space, it might be even more competitive and more brutal, because to get there is so tough that whatever species you meet up with, they are going to be survivors, they're going to be warriors, they're going to be absolutely deadly and ruthless. And if they even see the slightest problem with you, they'll wipe you out. They will destroy you, damage you, do anything to you that they need to do. They will look after themselves first. I don't think that life is anything about, multiculturalism, let's work together, friendly faces, yada, yada, yada. Go and look at all of history, look at all of science, look at what we know. I'm telling you, that does not come through at all. That British junk that you saw there, that is not the way the world is. And as you could see, that was pure propaganda, eventually heading off into, oh, let us take care of our democracy as flawed as it is. Stop, stop, get off the bus. Democracy? Where's democracy? There is no democracy. That's just a concept that we've invented. There is no such thing. There's no such thing as democracy in the animal world. It doesn't exist. That's just one of our soft, weak concepts that we've come up with in an attempt to try to stop war by replacing actual war with a ritual war. Democracy and voting is simply a ritual form of warfare. But otherwise, it's got all the terminology of warfare. Let me tell you, you cannot get away from competition, from determination, from power, from survival, from group forces, etc. These are the real lessons of survival and science. So, among our weaknesses, our greatest weakness as a race is our inability to multiply. This is something I'm going to come back to. Our inability to multiply is absolutely disgustingly, terribly pathetic. It's beyond imagination how pathetic we've become, and it's very terrible. One area where we are good is we are great at adapting. Whites are great at adapting. And adapting and being creative, this is a very important thing. And our only real weakness is our inability to multiply, but I'll return to that topic. Otherwise, we're quite fine. We've got everything we need. But when you listen to parasite messages, oh, we're all equal and democracy, even in the animal kingdom, the animals aren't equal. Even in many kinds of animals, they've got a hierarchical structure. They don't know what equality is. There are alpha males. There is a hierarchy. So just don't listen to all this other bullshit, man. This is just bullshit. These people are perverting science and trying in a perverted way to present history and, let's call it, the grand history of races and species and animals and misrepresent it as something that it isn't. Hitler was a man who knew science and history backwards. And he wasn't alone. He had lots of others whom he collaborated with. They looked at the way life is, and they came up with a system that was fantastic. And it was a team system, a hierarchical system that was a team system, and it was working like a bomb. And that system will work again. And a lot of his stuff was based on the Roman Empire, which itself is a hierarchical, aggressive system that we used to have. But whites have always been organizing into hierarchies, fighting as groups, whether it's Germanic tribes, Gauls, Celts, you name it. We've always functioned in that sort of group format, very much like these ants. And that is a valid survival mechanism. And now you hear all this other claptrap and go and be buddies across groups, and we need to bring all the groups together. Ah, what a load of bollocks, man. That is such a load of crap, complete crap. But I thought I'd just show you what nature really has to offer. And I have done another video about the sheer brutality of animals, especially sea creatures. Absolutely brutal. And it's about survival. And if this one needs to eat that one, and tomorrow the other one needs to eat the other one, they do it, man. They don't muck around. What we've got is a kind of a parasite that gets into our brain and messes with our brain. So our parasite comes and messes with our brain and tells our brain that we need to accept the parasite. And that is what our parasite, the Jew, does. He comes and tells you that you must accept him. And that's his way of survival. But the reality is, you don't need that. We can function the way we've always functioned, the way we functioned before Jews existed. Jews have only been around for about 2,800 years. Whites have been around for at least 40, 45,000 years. Big difference in time. Don't listen to these fools. We were surviving quite happily, quite merrily all along. We're just running into a problem that we've got all these parasites. And we must beware that the parasites don't destroy us. I see absolutely nothing wrong with us functioning as a team, just like those ants in their ant colonies, functioning as a team, working as a team, winning as a team, expanding as a team until the end of time. Hitler himself, at a point in that Hitler's table talk, Hitler himself said, because he was very fascinated by the Roman Empire, Hitler himself said, I can't see any reason why the Roman legions couldn't carry on advancing. He couldn't see any reason why the Romans couldn't have continued winning until the end of time. And that's exactly what I'm saying to you. If it's worked for the ants for 100 million years, and they're not the only animals that work as groups, they are just an amazingly successful animal, that's all. So yeah, beware of junk Jewish liberal crap propaganda that masquerades itself as science, as history, etc. It's pure garbage. Don't listen to it. Look at the real world. Look at how the world really is. And then you'll see that the real lessons of the world are much more in line, if not totally in line, with what Hitler and the Nazis did. So just don't buy into crap. They lie to you at every twist and turn, and they do everything that they can to misdirect whites away from the path of success. And we've always been successful, and we were becoming incredibly successful. And now you've got all this other garbage among us, all these enemies within, weaknesses within, parasites within, etc. Don't listen to the parasites, man. And look at the ants. Look at how they work with their own kind, how they function as a group, how they function with a high level of sophistication and specialization. We are an even higher form of life that has got even more sophistication and specialization. And one thing that I've noticed many times has been the attempt to argue that war is somehow wrong, that war is an anomaly, that war is something that can't occur, shouldn't occur, it's a sign of things going wrong. No, it's a sign of survival. It's a mechanism for dealing with threats to your group. When your group is threatened, then you have a group response to the threat. And now you've got all these enemies, weaklings, enemies within, all kinds of garbage and filth telling us to not defend ourselves as a group. That is just total bollocks, that. That's just total garbage, that. Don't listen to that kind of shit. This stuff is not logical. It is in no way academic. It is in no way a proper study of science, a balanced, detailed look at history or methods of survival, etc. This is just cheap junk propaganda. And the British seem to be inundated with this kind of crap, I must tell you. Anyway, so there you have it. Alex Linder was the guy who came up with the idea of hash team white. Well, let's put in hash team ant. because if Team White was like Team Ant, I want to tell you, there wouldn't be a corner of the earth that wouldn't belong to Team White. And guys like Ben Klassen of Creativity, he said that. He said that. And he was a great thinker. And he's also the author of The White Man's Bible. He was a great thinker, and he was trying very hard to come up with plans for whites decades ago. And I like lots of what Ben Klassen came up with. He was truly fantastic. Truly a great thinker. So, there you have it. Don't listen to junk science. Go and study nature and history properly, and you'll see there's absolutely nothing wrong with us. Stop listening to people who are talking all kinds of shit about behavior. Our only weakness, and I will return to this, our only weakness is not having tons and tons and tons of children. That's our only weakness. That is our only weakness as a race. Everything else about us is fine. And when people come and they start saying, oh, well, you know, you're so violent, you're so warlike, you're so this, you're so that. Oh, shut up, go away. Go away. We've been at it a long time. We've been successful. We've survived. We don't need to listen to a lot of claptrap. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.